Some of the content covered in this podcast may not be suitable for all listeners, as we cover serious and sometimes disturbing incidents. Listener discretion is advised. On the morning of the 1st of September, 1986, 16-year-old Jermaine Abrams, a student at Portland High School in Mitchells Plain, South Africa, was getting ready for school shortly after her parents had left for work. Suddenly, there was a knock on the door. The brutal series of events that followed would send shockwaves through the community of Mitchells Plain and mark the end of an era when the last female convict would be executed in South Africa. You're listening to the South African True Crime Podcast, Episode 1, The Murder of Jermaine Abrams. I'm your host, Shirley. Thank you for listening. In the 1970s, South Africans were racially divided into groups of whites, blacks, Indians, and coloureds by the apartheid government. The term coloured refers to an ethnic group composed primarily of persons of mixed race from diverse ancestral links. Their ancestry may include the indigenous people of South Africa being the Khoisan and Bantu-speaking African people, European descendants of British and Dutch settlers, and slaves imported from the Dutch East Indies, or a combination of all. People from India and the islands within the Indian Ocean region were also taken to the Cape and sold into slavery by the Dutch settlers. Despite major differences in the historic ancestry of these groups, they were classified as coloured by the apartheid government. Several generations later, the term coloured today does not have the same derogatory denotation as it does in the United States, for instance, and the coloured community are considered an ethnic group, just like any of the multitude of other tribal groupings within South Africa's borders. District 6 was famed for its proximity to the Cape Town city centre, as well as its view of the picturesque Table Mountain and harbour. On February the 11th, 1966, the apartheid government declared Cape Town's District 6 a whites-only area under the Group Areas Act of 1950. The act assigned racial groups to different residential areas in order to exclude non-whites from living in the most developed areas, which were now restricted to whites only. Over 60,000 of District 6 inhabitants were forcibly removed to the Cape Flats, over 25 kilometers away. The suburb had experienced a long history of removals, with black residents forcibly removed as early as 1901. This was intensified in the early 1960s when residents were perfunctorily given notice and informed of their new homes. This story takes place in Mitchells Plain, South Africa in the mid-1980s. Located on the Cape Flats, 30 minutes from the center of Cape Town, it is one of South Africa's largest suburbs. Created by the apartheid government as a resettlement township for middle-income colored families who had been forcibly removed from the more developed areas of Cape Town. Garpa and Charlotte Abrams were residents of Mitchells Plain, along with their only daughter, Jermaine. They had been forcibly removed from District 6 and had resettled into Mitchells Plain. By this time, the original 56 homes in Mitchells Plain had grown to more than 33,000, a rapid pace that would continue to characterize the suburb's later expansion. As there were no roads connecting Mitchells Plain to the city centre at the time, inadequate infrastructure and facilities to accommodate the rapidly growing community led the suburb to exist in an almost self-contained bubble. The unemployed quickly turned to crime to make a living, and major areas deteriorated into urban ghettos. But while crime was relatively low-key, there were already signs of the gang violence and drug abuse that would later plague parts of the suburb. Unlike most residents, Garpa and Charlotte Abrams were both employed and were well-respected, hard-working members of the community. Garpa worked in the printing industry in Belleville, while Charlotte worked for a clothing shop. Charlotte had been the love of Garpa's life since their teenage years in District 6. Garpa was a star rugby player who represented the Western Province in the South African Rugby Union. Charlotte chaired the supporters club of the local Silver Tree Rugby Club. After the birth of their daughter, Jermaine, their little family was complete. By her 16th birthday, Jermaine was an impressive athlete, dominating the 200-meter sprint in local high school sport. Despite the political upheaval of the time, with racial tensions running high, she was a typical teenager of her time. She was described as a lovely girl and an absolute joy to her doting parents. Twenty-two-year-old Sandra Smith was married to Philip Smith, a deep-sea fisherman from Mitchell's Plain who spent long periods at sea working on a fishing trawler. They had two small children, and Philip regularly sent home for Sandra and the children. They all lived with Sandra's parents in Mitchell's Plain. During his long absences from their home, Sandra had gradually developed a crush on a 17-year-old local boy from the area named Yassim Harris. In September of 1983, she sent him a note with some money. The note stated that she wanted to meet him at a nearby park. When Yassim showed up at the park, Sandra expressed her ongoing crush on him and explained that her husband was always away at sea. She invited him to spend the night at her house, and that was the start of their relationship. By the autumn of 1983, the pair had a fully-fledged affair and were deeply in love. Yassim Harris had been a juvenile delinquent since the age of 13 and a regular cannabis and mandrax abuser. Mandrax, usually sold as a tablet, is a highly addictive synthetic drug. The active ingredient in mandrax is methaqualone, better known as Quaaludes, which were a popular recreational drug in the 1970s due to its euphoric effects. It was known that at the time, the apartheid regime would regularly dump truckloads of mandrax into Mitchell's Plain gangs to essentially create a drug-dependent youth that could easily be manipulated and controlled and subsequently turned into spies. While the United States and Britain tightened controls around their use and dispensing, these drugs are still widely available in South Africa today. You may know the drug from disgraced American actor Bill Cosby, who was accused of using Quaaludes to drug and sexually assault women from as early as the 1980s. Yassim left school age 15 while in Standard 6, which is today's equivalent of the 8th grade, in order to get a job to supplement the family's income. His first job was working alongside his father as a car sound specialist. However, Yassim was dismissed after 6 months when it was discovered that he had stolen 10,000 rands in cash, as well as checks totaling 26,000 rands. He was convicted and sentenced to 6 lashes with a cane as a juvenile. The hiding, his father later claimed, made no impression on him at all. From that point on, Yassim's gradual descent into a life of unemployment and crime became almost inevitable. He drifted from job to job, became a member of a gang called the Hard Livings, and not long afterwards was arrested a second time for breaking into a school. He received another 6 lashes, but at this point had resigned to a life of petty crime and joblessness. Yassim secretly slept with Sandra every night at her home, while she supported his lifestyle by giving him money, which was sent to her by her husband. The money served to keep her young lover's interest and would range anywhere from 50 to 100 rands. Not surprisingly, he soon gave up any pretense of looking for work. After they had been seeing each other for about 6 months, their relationship faced its first crisis when Philip Smith returned home from sea and learned of his wife's affair from some neighbors. With the help of three of his friends, Philip responded by physically assaulting Yassim, leaving him battered and bruised. The assault would only momentarily deter the affair with Sandra. As soon as Philip went back to sea, the pair resumed their affair and grew increasingly comfortable living as a couple during Philip's extended absences. Despite their ongoing affair, Yassim continued to pursue other women. He had a particular liking for young schoolgirls closer to his age and would loiter outside local high schools before school started, chatting to the girls and planning dates for the afternoon. This is presumably how he got to know 16-year-old Jermaine Abrams, and from their conversations learned that Jermaine's family were quite wealthy. The affair between Yassim and Sandra continued for over 2.5 years. When Sandra's husband was ashore, they would stop seeing each other and then resume the relationship when he left for sea again. In 1985, Sandra became pregnant for a third time and was uncertain whether the father was her husband Philip or Yassim. When Philip returned home in March of 1986, he would find his wife in the arms of her young lover yet again. Yassim fled to avoid another physical beating, but this time Sandra followed, abandoning her children in the process. As far as Philip Smith was concerned, the marriage was over, and so was the free supply of money he had been providing. After the breakup of her marriage, Sandra and Yassim now began to live together in a rented apartment. Soon, their finances became tight as the remaining money she had received from her husband started to run out. Sandra would sometimes stay with friends, and at times, she and Yassim would find lodgings in Mitchell's Plain. But within a few short months, their financial situation became increasingly desperate. To make ends meet, Sandra and Yassim dabbled in video fraud, where they would rent video machines and then sell them. This fraudulent exercise didn't prove too lucrative, and on the afternoon of the 31st of August, 1986, they hatched a plan to break into the Abrams' home and steal valuables around the house, which they would be able to sell for cash. Yassim suggested this particular house because he claimed to have broken into the place a year earlier and had stolen a substantial amount of money. He was aware of the Abrams' daily routine and told Sandra that Mr. and Mrs. Abrams typically left for work before 7 a.m. and that their daughter, Jermaine, typically left for school at about 7:40 a.m. The next morning, Sandra and Yassim got up early and walked to the Abrams' house, arriving there at around 7:30 a.m. Yassim knocked on the door, and when Jermaine answered, he asked if he could use their telephone to make an urgent call. Yassim did not introduce Sandra to Jermaine and instead went up to her bedroom to speak with her alone. Sandra, waiting in the front room for some time, became increasingly impatient. She could hear their voices, but grew anxiously curious and wanted to know what was being said. According to court documents, Yassim told Jermaine, "Sandra and I are here for valuables, like maybe your mother's jewelry. We're going to tie you up and take a few things from the house. We need you to stay quiet and not to tell your parents that it was us who did this." Yassim locked the front door and put the key in his pocket. On the bedroom floor, lying on her stomach, they tied Jermaine up. They were startled by a knock on the front door, at which point Jermaine started to struggle and attempted to scream for help. As she struggled to get free, Yassim clamped his hand over her mouth while Sandra held her legs down. Shortly thereafter, the knocking stopped. Yassim went to the kitchen to get a dishcloth, which he tied around Germaine's throat and began strangling her. He would later claim that he had only intended to make her pass out so she wouldn't make any more noise. After some time, he let go, but Germaine was still responsive. Yassin, grabbing a knife from the kitchen, began stabbing her in the neck, but Germaine still wouldn't die. Throughout this ordeal, Germaine was pleading with her two assailants to let her live. Turning to Yassin, she said, "I don't want to die, Yassin." Yassin carried Germaine to her mother's bedroom, where she pointed out to where the jewelry was. Germaine, getting weaker at this point, had been stabbed more than 25 times. She was getting cold and asked for some water. They didn't give it to her. Yassin finally wrapped her in a duvet and then cut her throat, leaving her to bleed to death. They then stole jewelry and any other valuables they could find and fled. Germaine's body would later be discovered by her own father, who walked into his home to find a bloody trail leading to his bedroom. Two weeks later, Sandra was being questioned by the police regarding a video machine that she and Yassin had rented and sold. Unable to think and buckling under the pressure of enormous guilt, she suddenly confessed to the killing of Germaine Abrams. "I wouldn't have been able to live with it," she said. She then wept and under cross-examination admitted the two of them had strangled and subsequently cut the throat of 16-year-old schoolgirl Germaine Abrams. 2 weeks later, on the 15th of September 1986, Sandra Smith was formally charged with the murder of Germaine Abrams, and 5 days later, Yassin Harris was arrested and similarly charged. At their committal hearing at the Mitchell's Plain Magistrates Court on the 23rd of September, they pleaded guilty to murder, alternatively to culpable homicide, and to stealing 2,000 rands worth of jewelry. Although South Africa's court proceedings were based upon British law, it did not use a jury system, but instead a system of judge and assessors. The two were tried together at the Cape Town Supreme Court on December 1st, 1986, before Mr. Justice Munich, the judge president of the Cape Court, and two assessors. Both were represented by counsel and both attempted to shift the blame onto the other. Sandra maintained that Yassin had done the actual killing, and Yassin claimed that he had been dominated by Sandra, although they both admitted being present during the murder. Sandra was embarrassed by the revelations of her sex life with Yassin in court and seemed at times more concerned with these than the fact that she was on trial for her life. Having heard all the evidence, Mr. Justice Munich gave a full reasoned judgment in which he described Yassin as an appalling witness. He said it was clear that it was Yassin who had stabbed the girl and slit her throat to prevent her from identifying them. He also rejected Yassin's defense claim that he had been dominated by Sandra, which had been refuted by the psychiatrist giving evidence for the prosecution. He accepted that Sandra was demanding but not dominant, and there was no evidence to indicate that she forced Yassin to kill Germaine, nor that she had done anything to prevent the murder. He thus concluded that they were both equally responsible for the crime under the doctrine of common purpose. This is where, in the commission of a crime, where two or more persons are acting together, they become liable for the crimes committed by their fellow perpetrators. On the 11th of December 1986, they were both formally convicted of the murder of Germaine Abrams and for robbery with aggravating circumstances and remanded for sentence. 11 days later, they were brought back to court and received the mandatory sentence for murder. that they be hanged by the neck until they were dead. Additionally, Yassim received a 10-year prison sentence for the robbery, and Sandra was given 7 years for it. Sandra became hysterical when she was sentenced to death and had to be taken, struggling and screaming, to the cells. They were transferred to the country's only death row at Pretoria Central Prison, a facility on the outskirts of the capital where all South African executions were carried out. Their appeals were turned down, and the review of the trial transcripts to determine whether to recommend that the state president grant clemency, carried out by the Minister of Justice, failed to find any mitigating circumstances. As clemency was not forthcoming, the execution date was set for the 2nd of June, 1989. Only around 1 in 50 people convicted of homicide were actually hanged at this time, the majority serving a prison sentence. At 6:50 a.m. on the morning of the 2nd of June, 1989, Sandra was taken to meet Yassim for the first time in over 2.5 years. Together with two other men who had been convicted of murder, they were led down the 52 steps to the pre-execution room next to the gallows. Their death warrants were read to them, and they were given the opportunity to say their last words. Their hands were handcuffed behind them and white hoods placed over their heads, having a flap at the front which was left until the last moment. They were now led forward by warders into a large and brightly lit execution room. It was some 40 feet long with white painted walls. They would have seen the gallows beam running the length of the room and 7 large metal eyes from which the 4 nooses dangled. Sandra and Yassim hang side by side until they were dead. Hangings had become almost a weekly routine at Pretoria Central Prison, where the rate of executions had been steadily rising in the late 1980s. This trend contrasted the mounting pressure against capital punishment in much of the world. In 1987, South Africa executed 164 people, more than any other country in the world, according to Amnesty International. That was 4 more prisoners than were executed in Iran, and 32 more than in China that same year, 2 countries that had previously topped Amnesty's list. Of the 164 people hanged that year, only 3 were white. In the same year, 25 people were executed in the United States, which has a population more than 6 times that of South Africa. In 1990, President F.W. de Klerk ordered a moratorium on all executions, and capital punishment was abolished altogether by the incoming black government of Nelson Mandela on the 7th of June, 1995. Sandra Smith was the last woman to be executed in South Africa.